Cue Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 296th episode of the Weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 295 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C, so that's johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe, only one email per day, and it's free. www.johnmack13.com. Before getting into tonight's conversation, some announcements. First, personal. My latest book, The Trump File, a short collection of poems dating back to 2009 and a short story, all revealing my feeling for the present occupant of the White House, is now available on Amazon, both in print and in Kindle formats. Additionally, I am in the middle of editing the Hudson Valley Anthology 2009, a collection of the writers of slightly over 60 of today's writers. I am shooting for its release by mid-November. Then now, some local Hudson Valley news. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 23rd year, at 6:30 p.m. in the Mahopac Library on Route 6 in, surprisingly, Mahopac. More than 175 books have been published by writers from this group. Once a month, the same group also has a morning meeting on the third Wednesday of the month. So October's meeting will be on this Wednesday, October 16th at 10 a.m. at the Hill Boulevard Diner, which is on Hill Boulevard, just west of Route 6 in Jefferson Valley. There are also two poetry workshops in the area open to both fledgling and experienced poets, one in Mahopac and one in Yorktown. The Mahopac one is held on the second Wednesday of the month at the Mahopac Library at 6:30 p.m., and the Yorktown one is on the fourth Wednesday at the John C. Hart Library in Shrub Oak at 6 p.m. This month, the Mahopac workshop was held on Wednesday, October 9th, while the Yorktown one will next meet on Wednesday, October 23rd. If you're confused by the groups and the dates, you can email me at johnmack13@gmail.com. Finally, the the October open mic session of the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center will be on October 18th, this week, in the scenic Philipsey Mount train station overlooking the Hudson in Sleepy Hollow, New York. There will be a featured artist followed by an open mic session. The theme of the open mic this month will be Halloween horror, but readers are not bound by the theme. A complete guide to all of the center's many offerings can be found at writerscenter.org. That's WRITERSCENTER, one word, .org. Once again, anyone wishing any more information on these meetings may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. The last week's show with educator, photographer, writer, and historian George Robinson, while very interesting, had very poor sound at times due to problem with George's phone. The recording of the show will be available at the website, but the show will be redone. These problems came on the heels of the hacking of my radio service the previous week, when I'm supposed to have an old friend, documentary producer, agricultural economist, and consultant to foreign countries, Dr. Chip Mann, is my guest. The problems have been corrected, and Dr. Mann will be my guest next week, Sunday, October 20th. These were the only 2 weeks in 295 shows that I had these problems. It is extremely depressing, but I don't expect to have them tonight when my guest, as on the 296th in the series, as mentioned, is Garrett Axelbank, publisher of the newest information website, This is the Bronx, and the host of Bronx Talk and the Bronx Buzz on BronxNet. But I first met Gary probably over 20 years ago when I was on the faculty of the Bronx Monroe College, and Gary was broadcasting our local New York City sporting events. As I have long had a fanatical interest in both sports and broadcasting, we became friends, and I'm very happy to have him join us tonight. The listener wishing to join Gary and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold call participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. Good evening, Gary, and welcome to the show.
John, it's just a pleasure to be here, and I just have to say, I particularly like the musical theme because I actually played that theme. I was in the band and orchestra at my junior high school, and we actually played that Peter Gunn theme. So I thought that was pretty good.
I must have known that, Gary. let's start right at the beginning. Where'd you grow up, then go to early school?
Well, I grew up actually in the same neighborhood that I live right now, which is Van Cortlandt Village. And in the Bronx. And so I went to schools all around, actually, the neighborhood I still live in. So, I mean, we can list them. I went to PS 95 from K to 6. If you even want to go earlier, I went to the Amalgamated Nursery School. But then I went K to 6 at PS 95. And then went from 7 to 9 because the middle schools were different at that time. Now I guess they go from 6 to 8, but it was 7 to 9, and I went to junior high school 143, John Peter Tatar Junior High School, where I did play the Peter Gunn theme. And then from 10, senior year in high school at 12, I went to Dewey Clinton High School. If you want to keep going, I got my undergraduate.
No, we'll get to them.
Not yet? All right.
Do you remember what your interests and earliest aspirations were as a child?
I don't think I had aspirations, to be honest. I think I was kind of in somewhat of a fog, so those kinds of things had never occurred to me. But my interests, I guess, like any kid, any boys, maybe specifically, growing up in the Bronx through the I guess late 50s, but really early 60s. I was interested in sports, specifically baseball, and that has carried me through my life right now. Also, as I got a little older, I really was very interested in music, and all of that served me well professionally, ultimately.
Yeah, what about radio and TV? Were you into that as a kid? You spent a lot of time with
not,
that?
Not as a child, no. No, it really was much more developed. As I said, I got interested in music and listening to the radio as, I guess, freeform radio really developed in the late 60s and early 70s. And was very inspired by the music that I heard and by the personalities that I heard. And I think also the presentation of progressive radio, progressive music radio, I really related to.
I was in the late 50s and early 60s. I was into to Long John Nebel and to Jim Shepherd particularly, and also to WBAI.
I remember listening to Gene Shepherd, but it was not what I grew up on. I grew up on certainly, WABC, like all of us did, because that's how we got our music. But then as the music got more sophisticated, at WNEW-FM, to some degree PLJ, but it really was the progressive format that I was really interested in.
Dewitt Clinton had some magic basketball years when Tony Archibald played there. Were they a powerhouse when you were there?
They were always a powerhouse. I was at Clinton just after Tiny was there. And so I was there, I think, when Ron Behagen was finishing up his career. He ultimately became an NBA player. And I did see Tom Henderson, who was the big star, who ultimately, of course, also played in the NBA, played for the Celtics. And I can recall very clearly that I think we played Wingate. Clinton played Wingate in the city championship finals. And I believe it was the triple overtime, if I'm not mistaken. And Tommy Henderson took a 10-foot shot from the baseline to try and win the game, I think, after the triple overtime. And it did not go in, and Clinton lost. So that was my senior year. Maybe my junior or my senior year at Dewitt Clinton High School.
In the mid-1960s, my brother was the principal at Palm Memorial High School, where when Lou Alcindor from my old neighborhood went to later became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, obviously. And they were the class of the Catholic school leagues. But Rice High School had two guys that became NBA players, Charlie Yelverton and Dean Memminger.
The legacy of New York City basketball, if that's where we want to go and that's what we want to talk about, we could talk about it forever. Everybody knows players who played, and
yep.
Everybody in every school is somebody else. They, oh, that guy played for us, you know, that kind of thing, or they saw him in the schoolyards. That's one of the, the legends of my childhood, because we talked about that stuff all the time.
Is Clinton still the sports power? I know that there have been many changes in New York City school, like John F. Kennedy High School that had some really good football years, has, I believe, been broken up into smaller schools. Has Clinton had similar changes?
It's a difficult measure because I haven't followed it. But the one thing I can tell you, which I think is of great interest, is that, I guess it was last fall, I guess about a year now, Dewitt Clinton hired its basketball court for Tiny Archibald. And also, he would not permit them to do that unless they named the gymnasium after Dolph Shays. And so last fall, there was that presentation, and Danny Shays was there to represent his late father. And Tiny was there, and a whole bunch of NBA guys like Sack Sanders and the Earl of Pearl, who spoke beautifully about Tiny's abilities on the court. So the legacy is still there. I'm not the person to ask, because I just have not followed Bronx high school basketball that closely, certainly as I used to. Also, it is difficult for teams to maintain kind of that kind of superiority over time, because, you know, the schools have broken up. It's not like one individual school. So I'm just going to
happen to Kennedy
on that. I have no idea.
That was a class act by him to have him to insist that they named it after another guy, Dolph Schayes. That was a real class move.
Should not be a surprise. Tiny Archibald is a class act in every way you can imagine.
Did you write one
more thing about Tiny? He's had some health issues, and I think it was very, if they were going to do it, it was very important to do it now. While he's still, you know, young and vital and healthy. And, of course, we hope that continues. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. And when you were in Clinton, did you write for a school paper or did you get involved in any media things?
No, I never really did. As I said, I think I spent a lot of my youth and a lot of my schooling kind of searching for, you know, not really knowing what I wanted to do. And so my interest and then ultimately professional interest in media did not take hold that early. I mean, my interest in this very subject matters like music and writing and those things was there. And I don't know if you want to hear this anecdote, but the teacher that really changed my life was my junior teacher in English at the Dewey Clinton High School. And then you'll see almost the seeds for what I ultimately did professionally. And what I specifically remember is he took out, you remember the old Victrolas? He took out the old record player and took out Simon and Garfunkel's Bookends and played
it.
And that was one of the albums that had lyrics on the back. And he passed the lyrics around the room. And I distinctly remember it to this day because it signified to me that the music that I loved and the songs that meant something to me were poetry, were larger than just us kids kind of listening to the radio. And that act, and you could follow that through my professional career, that was really the initial. I mean, I never said, okay, now I want to be a DJ, which I ultimately did, but that set the seeds for me to understand what I would ultimately do. And so thank you to Mr. Greenhouse, 11th grade English.
My favorite writer at that time was, well, a lot of people say Jay Dillon, but I was a Kris Kristofferson person. And Sunday
really?
Morning Coming Down or Bobby McGee, they were like the national anthem to me. They were just wonderful.
Where did you hear those? Like, how did you get exposed to those?
Well, I used to listen to them on the radio. I was originally even though I was a rhythm and blues guy, then I hated when the American white guys like Tab Hunter and I tried to capitalize off the Clyde McFadders and people like that. Then I used to spend time at the Apollo Theater. I got away from it when the Frankie Avalons and that got into it, and I started to listen to Sinatra and the phraseology of his things, and then Johnny Cash brought me back, and Simon and Garfunkel, and I went to the Garden a number of times to hear Johnny Cash, and then he got me into Kristofferson, and it's just some of that writing is just so good, you know.
Well, that, I wouldn't dispute that, but what is interesting to me is that because right at that point, I after the, you know, Frankie Avalon and Paul Anka and those guys, I was waiting for you to say, and the Beatles brought me back, but you would be unique in that way during that period that you looked at Sinatra and Johnny Cash, whereas certainly for me and many others, it was John, Paul, George, and Ringo.
Yeah, it was also the Beatles for me, and it was Simon and Garfunkel, and with songs mm-hmm. like "The Sound of Silence," which is talk about beautiful poetry. I mean, that was terrific.
Still,
what did you do
still
after high school?
Relevant today, I have to mention, because if you listen to those lyrics and you look at what's going on out our windows today, same thing.
Absolutely. What did you do after high school?
So then I graduated Dewitt Clinton High School, and I went to Lehman College. And at the time, you know, the public universities in the city were free. And I remember that when they wanted to impose a $75 activities fee, there were literal protests, which I know I talk to students now, and they just can't believe it. That's what I did. I should interject. I went to Cortland State for a year. I actually thought I was going to be a gym teacher because I like sports. And as I mentioned, I did not have a real career path. So I spent my freshman year at Cortland State and then ultimately decided, you know what, I kind of like being not necessarily home, but being in the Bronx. And that was really, kind of a stake in the ground moment for me. And then ultimately I did go to Lehman College. I transferred to Lehman.
At that time, I believe it was still called Cortland State Teachers College. And I go back to when Lehman was Hunter College uptown, and Baruch at that time was City College downtown. And then they revamped them, and Lehman and Baruch became independent colleges in the city university.
Yeah.
What'd you major in?
I think when I was at Cortland, which was 1970, I graduated high school in 71. When I was at Cortland, I don't believe it was called Teachers College. They may have had a Teachers College, but they had broadened their offerings at that time. Just a technical point, that's all. But the other things you mentioned are true. When I got to Lehman, it had within a few years, become Lehman out of what was Hunter.
What did you major in at Lehman?
I was an English major.
And were you into writing and/or broadcasting?
Well, I guess really to start the first radio thing, I was in the student cafeteria at Cortland State, and somebody came in. This was really the crystalline moment, you know. Somebody, another student came in because they used to pipe the radio. The college, it was WCSU at Cortland State, and they used to pipe that into the cafeteria. And one of the students came in and said, "Hey, I got a show on that station." And I was like, that was the moment. And I was like, wow, you can have a radio show on a station? And they were like, yeah. And that was where I did my very, very first radio shows. I went in there and, they were kind of like, oh, yeah, you want to do the news? So they would, what we, of course, called rip and read. And you would rip stories off the Associated Press. And I would read the news, 5 minutes before the hour, for a number of newscasts. And then the DJ that had the show during that period of time said that she had to leave because she was going to be starting a student teaching stint. And who can we get to do the show? And I said, I'll do the show. And they didn't have a record library, and I remember you'd walk around and you'd collect records, because, of course, record albums were how you played stuff, and you'd collect record albums that you had and ones from friends in other rooms, and you'd walk up to the station with a pretty good-sized pile of records, and you basically played freeform radio, and I absolutely loved it, and that was definitely the first time I ever did radio. And then when I left Cortland to transfer back to New York and go to Lehman. Lehman had a radio station, WHLC, Herbert Lehman College, and I worked at that station for my 4 years, three and a half years at Lehman. So that was really how my broadcast career began. That is the germ of the moment.
And was it also DJ work, or was it news work?
I was a DJ. I was, as I think I said earlier, I was captivated by the music that I heard. That was what inspired me. And the whole idea was because it was free form, you could, you know, look what was going outside your window and play those records. And I spent a lot of time in my professional career as well doing that kind of thing. So on a sunny day, you would play Summer in the City. And on a rainy day, you would play Riders on the Storm. And this is kind of an important theme that has run through my professional career, using the world and myself as the medium to have people relook at the world in a new prism, so to speak. That is what I have done my entire professional life. And it began with that progressive radio where you were selecting your own records.
Now, later in life, you got into sports broadcasting. Did you do that at Lehman at all?
That was a hobby. That was never, and we can go into some details about the sports that I did. I mean, that's perfectly fine. But I always did sports as a hobby and never viewed it as something I would pursue professionally. I loved it. And I think I was pretty good at it. I was known as the voice of the CUNY conference for 12 years and did all their championship basketball games and a bunch of other stuff. But sports was always a hobby and a way to make a couple of extra bucks because I knew it. It was easy to do. I mean, well, I skipped way ahead. I mean, ultimately, I was a producer at Channel 4 Sports. And I realized that while it was fun to do, when it came to sports, if I didn't have that outlet as my kind of fun, doing it professionally ruined it for me as a fan. Certainly, but you know, if somebody said to me, "You want to do some play-by-play now?" I'd jump at the chance. I loved it, and I loved especially doing local sports. It was great.
One of my radio heroes was Marv Albert, and before him,
yeah,
Marty Glickman.
Uh-huh.
And I still know all their calls. Glickman would be good, like Needix, when he could still do that, and just like Mel Allen had the Ballantyne Blast, and Marv would have a.
Yes.
To Bradley in the corner. Yes.
I can still hear his voice.
Yeah. And what happened after college then?
So I did radio at WHLC. You know, then at that point, it became a kind of a serious thing. And my parents were pushing me. They both were educators and I have two brothers and they pushed us all to be, you know, intelligent and pursue what we liked. And I liked radio and said, you know, I would like to do this. And so I ultimately went to broadcast school at a place called Announcer Training Studios, which long since disappeared. So my parents basically said, you should be properly trained if you're going to do this. Then we don't want you just to think that you're properly trained because you spun records at the college radio station. You should get an education in it. So they paid for me to go to a vocational school, and I think I did pretty well. When I look back and people in the class, I don't know how many of them really ultimately got professional careers, but I took it seriously, and they taught me how to get a job. And ultimately, I got my first job at in Ocean City, Maryland. What was it, SOC? I can't believe I can't remember the call letters of the station. SEA was later. It was a station in Ocean City, Maryland, and it'll come to me eventually. I drove down there. This is actually a funny anecdote. I put everything I owned. My parents kissed me goodbye. I actually had a cat at the time, and I put everything I owned into a blue Ford Fairlane and drove it down from New York to Ocean City, Maryland, about a 4 or 4.5 hour drive. And as I was driving, the rain got worse and worse, and it was a hurricane. You can look it up, whatever the hurricane was in the summer of 1976. And by the time I got to Ocean City, there was a foot of water at this little seafaring town. And I stepped out of my car and I walked into the radio station. Of course, radio stations are places of great panic during big storms like that because they have some responsibility, especially in those days, as the only communication outlet. And I walked in. The place was in an utter panic. And I spoke to a program director named Rocky Rockwell, who had one eye, which I always will remember, classic small-town radio. And he showed me, and this was literally the first day of my broadcast career, and he showed me on a map. Of course, we didn't have digital maps at the time. And he said, if the high tide hits at this particular time when the eye of the storm is here, Ocean City will be wiped out. And I was like, wow, here I am. Everything I own is out in that car that is filling up with water. And you're telling me if we get unlucky, we're all going to be gone. And that was my first day in broadcasting.
I know that you were in both Maryland and Delaware, and I know
right.
that most people who eventually come to New York, or even back to New York, they have to start in small towns and stuff. How long were you in these places?
So I was at, goodness, I can't believe I can't remember the name of the Ocean City radio station. But I was at that station maybe for 9 months or so, and then they closed down, and I needed a job right away. I mean, I was living there with my cat in a trailer, as a matter of fact. And so I got a job at the local rock station, which is where I aspired to be anyway. And that was WSEA in Georgetown, Delaware. And I moved to, I may have come home for 6 months or a couple of months and then drove back there. I don't remember the details. We're talking 1977. So I was there, I think I was there another year at WSEA. And I don't even remember why I ultimately left, whether they changed the format. I just don't know. But I did leave. And then got a job up in Westchester at the WRNW, which was the Rock of the North Woods in Briarcliff Manor. And that was the station I wanted to work for, because it was a progressive station. The DJs played their own music. And of significance to a lot of people, Howard Stern was the program director. He's the one that hired me to be a DJ at that station. I had had progressive radio experience. I knew the music. I knew the style because I had grown up listening to WNEW-FM. And so I got a job as the 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. jock. And I did that for maybe a year, 2 years, and, you know, worked with Howard and a bunch of other wonderful people who I still count as friends, or haven't seen them all. I mean, Earl Bailey, who's well known, and Donna, who's now, I think she's still on BAB, and my longtime friend Bruce Figler worked for the midnight, the 2 a.m. shift after me. We're still close friends. And Curtis Kay, who's now been the morning man in New Jersey for many years. And that was a wonderful, wonderful experience, a great growth experience. I loved the music. I loved, that was exactly what I wanted to do. But then Howard left to seek his fortune, which he did eventually get pretty quickly, as a matter of fact. And they ultimately hired me to succeed him as the program director in 1980. And so I was really all of 28 years old and the program director of this radio station. And I think we did a pretty good job. There were a lot of pressures from very poor ownership. I don't know if it's worth saying, a man named Fred Schreier, who ultimately, he's deceased now, but you can look it up. He ultimately was a child molester, and he was arrested for that. And that's the that will forever be on his epitaph. But he was a cheap son of a gun. And so it was a lot of pressures. But we did some wonderful things. We ran, like always, I was into local music, and so I developed a weekly program called Spotlight 107, where I would play the music of local artists, and which is a theme of my entire broadcast career. And it was a wonderful program, and I got really friendly with many of the musicians, and we used to go to clubs every night to hear them. And, you know, the process was a little different than what it is today. Now, of course, you can email a song or something and quickly put it on. But there I had to go and find tapes and get people to send me tapes or send me their records and stuff. But we had a wonderful, wonderful program that I was very proud of during that period of time. And so we took those bands and I put on concerts. At using the muscular dystrophy people that had an annual concert, we kind of blew it out. The radio station blew it out. And we ran these beautiful music festivals at the Kensico Dam, at the foot of the Kensico Dam. And certainly I remember the groups, and I have good reason to remember Guy and Pip Gillette and Margaret McGlynn. And we ran some wonderful concerts. People came and picnicked, kind of a latent Woodstock thing at a much smaller level, but beautiful summer days when you heard local music, and that was the highlight. And by the way, the reason that I mentioned Guy and Tip Gillette is ultimately they played at my wedding. so we maintained.
It's amazing how it's changed, though, as you say. I'm talking to Bill Mazur once, and he started his broadcasting career up in Buffalo, and he was a general-purpose guy then. And he said he remembered Betty Clooney, who was Rosemary's sister, coming to the station with her records, with her manager, and talking to them and getting them to play her records on the air. And that was how it was then done.
That was
then
how it was
back.
Done. Listen.
And then when I was interviewed once for something on WLNA in Peekskill, it was both a talk show and the music show, and all of the music was on 8-tracks, and it came in from a service that they didn't pick it out, and then they just put the 8-track in, and away they went. So it changed dramatically, and it took away that selection process from the DJ.
Yes,
no,
I can talk, the next step in my career, I can talk very specifically about that. But your comment there inspired another very wonderful memory, actually, is that Joan Jett, who is now in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I believe it was her second album, and she was going to all the local stations to give to get them to play the record. And I was the program director at the time, and at that time I was back down to doing daytime radio. I was on 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And she came to the station giving out record albums out of the trunk of her Cadillac, and I sat with Joan Jett, and she played her You Don't Own Me was the song, and what was the I can't remember the names of the songs. If I saw the album, Don't Touch, Do You Want to Touch Me was the hit off that album, and I was one of the first in New York to play that, and I interviewed her. And I will add, R&W had a wonderful music reputation, and one of the other artists who came, and I had a wonderful time interviewing her, actually another interview I would talk about as well, which is fascinating, was Ronnie Spector. And Ronnie was trying to resurrect her solo career, and she came up with her new record album. And I remember sitting with Ronnie Spector and actually getting her to sing a cappella, Be My Baby, on the air, which was amazing to hear that voice. But the other story, which is an indelible story, and this year in particular, it's well worth telling, is that in 1979 was the 10th anniversary of Woodstock, and being a progressive rock station, this was an important a moment for us, the 10th anniversary of Woodstock, and we had Richie Havens up in the studio, and I interviewed Richie Havens literally on whatever it was, August 15th, 1979, and he told the story of how he opened the Woodstock Festival to me and my audience on the air. And then, again, the way things have changed, he needed to get back to Brooklyn, and there wasn't really not a way to do it, so I said, I'll drive you. And I had an incredibly memorable time, just me and Richie Havens in my car driving down the Deegan, me driving him back to, I guess it was Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn, and it was 3 p.m. right at the same time that he hit the stage exactly 10 years before, and he was telling me, I'll never forget this, he was telling me that it was an overcast day, and he looked out the car window and he said, wow, just like today. And he got teary-eyed remembering that he was the guy who they said, Richie, you better get out there because, with all the weather, it's going. And so I had Richie Havens tell me firsthand, one-to-one, alone in an automobile, about what it was like to open the Woodstock Festival, literally to the minute that he opened it 10 years prior. So thank you for inspiring those memories. I mean, those were great memories.
But you just inspired one with me. I saw him tell the same story. It must be 12, 15 years ago. He came up where John Hall, who was the lead singer for I'm Still the One, he was running for Congress, and Richie Havens came up and he opened up the thing out in Dowling Park or in FDR State Park singing and talking about Woodstock and introducing John Hall, you know. So
and John, yeah. John ultimately was a congressman and a very good one, as I recall. Somebody I would support again, especially in this day.
He was a terrific congressman, and he was defeated by the woman who's the wife of the Camount medical network, and she lasted one term, and then she was defeated by Sean Maloney. One more question about Bar NW was. Did Howard Stern have his outrageous act there, or was he different and did develop
Howard,
it later?
Great question, John. Howard was developing his act. It was a soft music station, so you know we weren't allowed to play rock and roll. Frankly, I'm the one that helped broaden the playlist during my time as program director. But when Howard was program director, it was soft rock, and coming out of the 70s. That was appropriate because, you know, there was Light FM debuting in the city. And so, you know, they thought the way to get adults was to, you know, keep it on the soft side. But Howard was the program director. Here's the irony. And he would go into the production studio. Now, you picture little radio stations with one production studio. That's where you'd make all your commercials, all your promotional announcements and stuff. And Howard would lock the door in that production studio because he was working on all his bits and he didn't want anybody to hear them. So we couldn't even do the business of the station because Howard had occupied the thing. And it was clear that he wanted to get out and that, you know, once he could get out, he did. And I think his first job was a WW DJ. The one thing I remember, he was, again, you picture regular music radio. He started taking phone calls, and that was really a revolutionary thing for rock radio. I mean, you didn't do that kind of thing. And one of the things I remembered, he used to order his lunch literally live on the air, which was just – it was outrageous. You'd never heard anything like that before. He gets all the credit for literally inventing it.
I don't know if they can do that anymore, but I remember Jim Gerhardt on WNEW. He used to call places as though he wanted to order something and ask them – if they had really wacky stuff and, yeah. You know, they'd be selling glue and he'd say, well, I've got this airplane. Will it hold the wings on? And he'd be talking to these people. So it was a real thing.
Maybe Howard didn't invent it. Howard just brought it to rock radio.
I haven't heard them do that for years though. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
you gotta be talented. But the one thing I remember is he called the lunch place called Tomaine's. He called it Tomaine's. He said, I'm going to call it Tomaine's for lunch. And then even if they got it wrong, he would call them back and send it back. So that was really all that he had done in that way. I saw him several years later, and he was wonderfully nice. And it was just like meeting any other old friend that you meet from the business, despite the fact that, of course, now he's, you know, one of the largest broadcast stars in history.
Is it now when the studio was running out of money, what happened to it? Did it close, and did you have to leave, or you already?
RNW did not close. Well, I can't really say the history of the station. Now it's the peak, and it's doing very nicely. I don't really remember a lot of the mechanics of that. I did get fired as the program director. There was kind of somebody who undermined me. We don't have to go into it. And I did get fired, and that was the end of that job.
And what happened then?
All right. So then, and I don't remember how much time was in between. I was teaching broadcasting at first at ATS, where I had gone to school, and then a new school that had opened up called the Center for the Media Arts, which was a broadcast training school. And I ultimately became the dean of the broadcast program, teaching future broadcasters. And then about the same time, I got a job at WDHA in Dover, New Jersey. As a DJ at a rock radio station, a very good station that's still on the air. And as I said, my friend Curtis Kay is the morning man, and he's still just a great guy. You know, if I walked into him today, we'd have the same one of those kinds of people that you'd always have the same relationship with. Yeah. Curtis is still there, but I worked as a DJ for 2 years, and basically continued the process, not necessarily of local music, but presenting new music. And I, goodness, I can't remember the name of the show, but I had a weekly show that presented new, Virgin Vinyl was the name of the show, that presented new music. And so what I loved about it, frankly, that, because I was the guy that had that show, all the record companies would send me their record albums. So all the years, I mean, I've collected and still have thousands of record albums, which I guess we're not going to get rid of. They occupy a pretty big wall in my living room. But I did that program, Virgin Vinyl, for a couple of years. On my evening show, I worked 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. And then, unfortunately, that station was paying people pennies. I was making whatever, $5.35 an hour or something like that, driving an hour out to Dover, New Jersey every night. It was kind of crazy. And I remember asking management, a raise or pay for my gas or something. And they gave me all of a dime, which is tells you something about how cheap they were. And about how, so I went from $5.35 to $5.45 an hour. And when you're doing 3 hours work and you get $15 a night, that's not a lot of money. So that's why I had that day job of teaching broadcasting. And then ultimately, announcers were very upset about being paid by those kinds. And we brought in the union, and I basically got finked out. I thought, you're a little naive, I guess, when you're that young. So I was in my 30s, and said what I thought at union meetings about how important it was. And it turns out there was a think in the audience and told management that I was one of the people that brought the union in. And ultimately they put me on like Saturday overnight on the AM station, which is not what I did for a living. And I did it for 1 week and then just said, well, I'm just going to leave. And they did squeeze me out. And so that was essentially the end of my radio career. And I was,
so how'd you, how'd you get in to network television then?
Well, cable television would be more accurate. I was teaching at the Center for the Media Arts, which was a school across from FIT on 26th Street. Very long story short, it was to become the Mercy College New York City campus. Mercy was going to buy it, but through issues with the federal government and a bad loan that CMA had, the deal fell through, and that's how the school ended. But anyway, a gentleman named David Medina came to the broadcast program and the TV program at the Center for the Media Arts. Wonderful concept. I mean, it was a media school with a recording studio and graphics studio and photography and TV and also how to be an announcer. And he came there and he said, I'm starting a cable station in the Bronx. And I'm looking for interns. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute. A cable TV station in my hometown. And my wife, Suzanne, and I still lived in the Bronx. And I said, it's almost like a dream come true, because I'd always believed in what you're doing, John, and that's grassroots radio and grassroots broadcasting. And I said, every neighborhood in the Bronx should have a radio station. Of course, that was the media of the day. And so this idea that the Bronx was going to get cable TV, I was like, wow, that is phenomenal. One thing I do want to mention, one of my students at CMA was a guy named Chris Maloney, who went on, I believe, to be a star on L.A. Law. I can't take credit for his wonderful television career, but he was one of my students. So that's kind of a side note. But anyway, that's what happened, and that's how my eyes got opened to, because I had perceived, now we're getting into what Gary really ultimately did for his professional career. I always perceived that that was the foundation of broadcasting, is that you could, you could use it to make people's lives better in local communities. And here was they starting a cable station in the Bronx. Dream. This is exactly what I'd always, I didn't know it, but that's exactly what I always wanted. So I got involved. And, making the, again, years long story short, I was there when they debuted. And actually, this is the perfect, good for you, perfect timing. They debuted BronxNet Television on July 1st, 1994. So today, this week, Bronx will be celebrating celebrating its 20th with a luncheon at the Marina del Rey on Thursday. But also,
all of a sudden, you're going in and out, Gary.
Again?
All of a sudden, you're going in and out.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
When they debuted the station, I had the first feature ever. In other words, they had a anchor who said, "Hey, welcome to BronxNet Television, and here's our first feature." And it was a feature of a chess player, a young man who had won a national championship in chess from the Bronx, which really signaled the future of what BronxNet Television was to become. So I did some news stories, some fun news stories. When Mickey Mantle passed away, I did a feature on that. So I did a little sports in that way. But I did a lot of features on high schools and all kinds of other things, which I enjoyed on the news show. And then someone came to me. They had a new executive director named Jim Carney, who ironically I had given a job to as a DJ. He had graduated Fordham and was one of the DJs I had hired at WRNW. He was now my boss at BronxNet. And they came to me and said, "Hey, you want to do a talk show?" Because he knew that I was kind of somewhat of an accomplished announcer at the time. And I said, "Yeah, wow, that's great." And so that's when Bronx Talk debuted, which has been my weekly TV talk show on BronxNet for 25 years. And again, your timing is impeccable because this past Friday, October 11th, was the 25th anniversary of Bronx Talk Television. And I
wow.
had I've done more than 1,200 programs. I moderate all the political debates. If you were to name anything in the Bronx over the last 25 years, I have represented it on the program. I mean, you can go through it. Rudy Giuliani was on the show. David Dinkins was on the show. All the politicians and musicians, DJ Kool Herc, who basically invented hip hop, was on the show. Eddie Palmieri was on the show. I mean, you can go on and on. Every elected official essentially has been on the program. And it's something I'm quite proud of, and that will be on my epitaph one day, is that I was the host of this wonderful program that is still going strong today.
And over 20 years after that debut, you became the host of the Bronx Buzz in 2016.
Right.
What is that?
So what happened was BronxNet Television expanded. Now, we have our studios in the sub-basement of Carmen Hall at Lehman College, and it expanded to open a satellite studio at Mercy College in the East Bronx at the Hutch Metro Center, and they were looking for programming, and I'm always interested in doing interesting stuff, and so the idea was to bring journalists out there so that they could learn that BronxNet has an East Bronx facility. And so we added the Bronx Buzz, which is a weekly program where I interview journalists. And, we do two a week. There's not 104 journalists in the Bronx. So to extend it, we bring on photographers and filmmakers and authors and other people who serve the Bronx with media. And it's a wonderful show. It's a lot lower key than the much more formal Bronx Talk. I don't wear a suit. I wear a tie, but no suit. And it's a fun show for me to do because I get to meet and interact with all of the journalists and all the media people in the Bronx. And the sum total of it is that I have a range now of, you look at sum total of Bronx Talk for 25 years, the Bronx Buzz now, where I know personally and intimately all of the journalists in the Bronx, I have a very good Rolodex or database of every politician, every community board, every neighborhood in the Bronx, because I've covered it. I've just whatever's been going on in the Bronx, I have been representing on my programs for the last 25 years.
A good friend of mine, and I've been on his show a couple of times, does a show for for Comcast Television in Putnam County, and it's a he interviews first for a long time. There was only writers, but now he interviews anyone that they feel has the passion for what they do, and if you're a guest when you walk out of the show, they hand you a DVD of the show, and it's also up on YouTube. So he gets people from Connecticut and from the city and all that, you know. It's
right.
We've
limited the scope to the Bronx.
Right.
But all the shows, they're also, of course, on YouTube and everything else.
Now, you also have your own production company. Now, is that the umbrella for some of the other things that you do?
Yeah, one quick word about BronxNet and the beauty of BronxNet, and I give a former borough president, Fernando Ferrer, the credit, is that when they conceived it, they conceived four channels. Three would be public access, and one would be a professional channel, and to serve the Bronx, which is underserved with media, and I've been part of, obviously, the professional channel. And so, I'm sorry, John, your question was again?
I'll get to that in a minute. There was a friend of mine then that you probably know. The reason he was a friend of mine, he was my editor years ago at Computer Living New York. But he also is the editor of, or he was the editor of a Bronx paper that had been around for a long, long time. And of course, his name just went out of my head.
I was going to say, you give me his name. It's quite possible. I know him, certainly all the people. Do you know what paper it was?
It was a Bronx paper, and I believe it was originally out of the Co-op City, and a lot of people knew him. It was Ron something, I think. But he founded Computer Living New York. I used to write for that every week.
Bronx News and the Co-op City Times came out of that area, but both are defunct.
The Bronx News. Who was the editor of the Bronx News?
Hagedorn. Oh, well, Hagedorn was the publisher. Michael Horowitz was an editor, and Dan Gesslein was an editor.
No, they weren't them. My question was, though, you have your own production company. Now, is that the umbrella of the things that you do?
Yes. So, in other words, you got to establish something. So, I don't know, somewhere in the 90s, I did establish Gax Productions, and I did things like I had done a weekly radio program called City High Focus. I did that for the Board of Ed, where we'd go to different high schools. And, you know, that's just the kind of stuff I've always been interested in. I also produced a video for the Black Women in Sport Foundation under the umbrella of Gax Productions. But it really had been dormant until, I guess it was the fall of 2016, where I kind of said, you know, it's time for a new project. And we developed something called This is the Bronx. It's a website at thisisthebronx.info. And so the company is Gax Productions. But at the moment, our only product is thisisthebronx.info, which, again, I'm very proud of it. It's a very good piece of media for the borough of the Bronx.
That's what hooked you and I up again after the number of years when I sent you a poem, which I think is in the queue for one of your publications.
Yes.
And that was only for you. I didn't, and you came back to me and you said, I'm submitting it. I said, sure, you know, so you've got it.
Yeah, but the thing is, we have we put out news every day about the Bronx. And here's the theory, John. I think you and listeners will find it interesting. This is the theory that I work on. There were 1.4 million people in the Bronx. And then I always ask, how many people live in Boston? 600,000, less than half. But Boston has network television and daily newspapers, including one of the most famous in the country, in the Boston Globe. Think of how underserved those 1.4 million people in the Bronx are from media, to get news every day, to find out what's going on. And that's what This is the Bronx is about. We don't do violence. We don't do politics. We just really talk about development, healthcare, you know, all the schooling, education, all the kinds of things, the features of all different people in this very wonderful, diverse borough of the Bronx.
I often go to a a monthly luncheon, which is in Yonkers. Well, it's on the Yonkers side of McLean Avenue. It's called the Narrowbacks, and the Narrowbacks is a term they used for the sons of the Irish immigrants who got off the boat and had to work hard. They were the broadbacks, and then the ones who went to school, they were the narrowbacks. And there was a historian there of the Bronx, and he talked about how when they opened up the trains, that the population of the Bronx went from something like 300,000 to over a million in 10 years around the turn of the century, because people could get into Manhattan to work. And there's some fast stories come out.
I don't know if it was Professor Lloyd Alton, who is the Bronx Borough historian, who did that lecture, but it is a matter of record that as the subways developed, the lines that, the IRTs and the INDs, as they developed, that's what developed the Bronx, because the Bronx developed around the subways. That is a matter of, so you've quoted something that's completely accurate.
There's another fellow that was he was the Yonkers cop out of the Bronx, but he has some fascinating stories about when he was young in the University Avenue area. They used to let him ride on the fire trucks when he was like 12 years old. He was a fire. And he was there when a fireman from my neighborhood fell off like the sixth story in a building and broke his back, and they carried him out, who later went out on disability, that thought he was going to die. But he has all these stories about growing up there, and being allowed to ride on the fire trucks from the house and everything.
It's hard to believe, but I guess it did. It is true. Stranger than fiction.
He told me one of the wildest stories I ever heard. When he was a Yonkers cop, they got a call in the car that a state police car had gone off the grid. They couldn't reach this. Keep your eyes out for him. And they were the first one to find this police car with a dead cop in the car.
Right.
And apparently the story was that they had pulled a guy over for a traffic violation, and when they found out that his license was suspended, he couldn't drive the car. So he said, "Well, I'm a hunter. Can I get my shotgun? There's nothing in it out of the trunk and that." And he said, "Yeah." Well, the guy got out blazing. He killed the cops. He escaped, and they couldn't find him. The next day, some woman who worked for IBM disappeared from some other place, and they didn't see any connection at all. But they found that this guy had a hunting cabin in the Catskills, and they went up to the Catskills, and they found the woman dead, the same woman, and without her car, and without her face. This guy had skinned her face. And he drove across.
I'm happy that you've told me this story.
What?
I'm joking. I said, I'm so happy that you've told me this story.
And he drove across the Canadian border wearing this woman's face. And he was eventually caught, and he was killed and everything. But, I mean, this guy has so many fascinating stories. He'd be a good guest for you, because many of them, they're Bronx stories.
Kind of story I wouldn't pursue, but that's okay.
This is the Bronx. You also that spins off also a weekly magazine, right?
Well, we call it Weekday Magazine, which is an opportunity for people of the Bronx, mostly people of the Bronx, who do take essays from anywhere, can submit material, and so
okay.
It's kind of an open forum. It's just a way to describe the opportunity for us to publish original writing.
That's good, yeah.
That's what we do.
I spent 12 years in Riverdale before I moved up here, so I'm familiar with not only where I grew up, but where you grew up and all around there. What's next for you? Before I ask that question, for the audience, the site is This Is the Bronx, all one word, .info. So that's T-H-I-S, thebronx.info.
Oh, thanks so much for doing that. Yep.
What's next for you, Gary?
What's next? Well, I'll be honest with you. I mean, I'm older than I once was and younger than I'll be, but that's not unusual. I hope to just continue to do what I do. I have a beautiful wife. I have two children who are grown. My son is a TV news reporter in Tampa, and he does the news. And if you look up Evan Axelbank, you'll get to see what he does. And he's really a very talented and, I think well-respected news journalist. And I'm proud of him. And I'm very proud of my daughter, who is a fitness instructor and really is paving new paths for people. And she's also incredibly talented. And so we're just, my wife and I, Suzanne and I, we're just going to keep living. We're going to do the things that that we're passionate about, which is, our work. And my wife is an artist, and she cuts children's hair as well. And so we're just going to keep living and living life to its fullest. I mean, project, I think people can hear what I like to do. If there's opportunities to announce or opportunities to do more programs or different kinds of programs or also to teach, I love teaching young people. One of the joys of what This Is the Bronx has been is that I've been able to work with college interns and really help them learn to write and learn to, do media. And I think it's worked out very well. So I'm just going to keep on keeping on, I think would be the way to say it.
We've touched a lot of bases tonight. What else would you like our audience to know about you?
I'm a really big Mets fan. I love the Mets. I love baseball. I'm a season ticket holder for the Mets. There's a lot of polarity now, especially with the Yankees in the playoffs. But my passion really is the game of baseball. I love it. And I see it through, using the word again, prism. I see it through the prism of the Mets. And it's incredibly enjoyable for me to just go to the games and go with my family and go with my friends and dialogue with my kids about it. And so that's really what I'm passionate about. The other thing, which is an aside, one of the things I did along the way was I taught music at Mercy College. I taught the history of pop music.
Wow.
Interesting side anecdote is that my interview for the job, they were looking for somebody to teach, kind of these music chronicle or music history sessions. And my appointment was for December 9th, 1980, to do that interview. And that, of course, history will show, was the morning after John Lennon was killed. And
right.
So I went in there, and the dean of the music department at Mercy College was, and I said, I got to tell you, I'm very distracted because, last night John Lennon was killed. And he said, you know what? That probably means you're perfect for this job. And so I created a course called The World of the Beatles. And so I don't want to say that I'm a Beatles historian, but it's still the music that really inspires me. And so I did teach music at Mercy College. One of the side notes was that I taught at Sing Sing, and I would go and bring records and play music for the people who are incarcerated and teach them about rhythm and blues and stuff that I'm really passionate about. That's also been part of my life, is teaching music and believing in the stuff that I listened to as a kid.
Based on what you said about the Mets, I have to tell you that I was in Joan Payson's private club the night the Mets won the World Series. And I didn't belong there.
I would have to be. Yeah.
I was there two nights before when the Mets won a game, and I had tickets that someone had given me to both the game and to the Diamond Club. And I'd never been in the Diamond Club at Shea. So I'm walking along, and there's all these people with suits. They're walking into this door, and I just walked in with them. And I noticed they weren't serving. I was going to get a hamburger. And so I went to the bar. I noticed there was no money changing hands. And I ordered a beer, and the guy next to me says, as I like a cigarette, because you could smoke in bars then, he said, would you hold that light for me? I turn around, and it's Gordon McRae, who had sung the national anthem. And I looked down over his down the bar, and Joe DiMaggio was talking to Earl Warren, and I said, I guess I'm not in the right place. So I stayed there. I immediately switched from Via to Drambuie, and I stayed there in the evening. Then I was there when they won the last game, and I went with five of my friends back in there, and when the guard said, we're all in suits coming from Wall Street, and the guy said yes, and I said, I'm with the Clipper. And we walked in, and Pearl Bailey was there, and Weeb Eubank was there, and Shipwreck wow. Kelly, who once owned the Brooklyn Dodger football team, was there, and Casey and Edna and John Lindsay and Pearl Bailey. It was just a wonderful night. Then I go downstairs, and there's one cab left. I'm going to Riverdale. So I get in the cab, and the guy said, I'm holding the cab for Haywood Heilbrun. I said, Haywood has to go back to the studio in the truck. They're doing some filming. He told me he's at the cab. And the guy said, okay, where do you want to go? And I said,
that's funny.
Riverdale.
Good job. That's a great story.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well,
I was at game
you.
Six, which would be my only claim to fame there. Anyway, John, it's really been a pleasure. You know, you work real hard, and you don't really. The lyric from James Taylor is, you know, we never count the time, but it's nice when somebody asks you about what you do and where you've been, and I really appreciate it.
Sweet Baby James, yeah. He was also one of my favorites. I Seen Fire and I Seen Rain. I saw him on about 2 years ago. He and Carol King were on together, and he really got her to sing. She was, in addition to writing, she was in his backup group, and he got her out singing, you know, and she did okay. I go back to the original Hound Dog by Willa Mae Thornton, and the original Shaboom by the Chords, and Joe Turner with the original Sheck Rattle and Row. That was my music that I got into, and then I used to go to the Apollo, and I used to go across the street to Clyde McFadden's record store, and I had a wonderful time with the music, you know. So.
Well, let me just, you mentioned Shaboom and the Chords. One of the things that the Bronx is well known for is basically inventing doo-wop. And so I brought them all together, and we went to a street corner in Morrisania where they used to sing as kids. And I did an edition of Bronx Talk there, and there's a wonderful, it's from 1995, a wonderful rendition of Shaboom with the guys who originally did it, sitting on a park bench in the Bronx.
Wow. Now, Frankie Lyman and Louis Lyman, they were Manhattan kids, though. So,
yeah,
that
is true.
Yeah.
So, anyway, John, it's just been an absolute pleasure. And I can't thank you enough for thinking of including me. And I look forward to it. I don't have another life to talk about, but I'm happy to talk to you at any time about anything.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Gary. As you said, it's been a real pleasure. Send any comments or questions about the show to me or any URLs to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And be sure to join me again next week at the same 7 p.m. Eastern Time when my guest is Dr. Charles Chip Mann. Go to my website, www.johnmack13.com, for the URLs of the previous shows, and my books are available on Amazon. Now, in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after a Mets win, put it in a book. And until next time, as you say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Let's go off again with the Eagles and taking it easy. Amazon, play Take It Easy.
Playing Take It Easy from your library on Amazon Music.
On the road to the things
I got 7 women on my mind.
Well, good night, everybody. One, two, three, eight, of time. it easy.